This is Juvie, a podcast that explores cases, legislation, experiences, and ramifications of children and youth in juvenile and adult criminal justice systems.
Every year, the Campaign for Youth Justice devotes the month of October to raising public awareness, strengthening coalitions, and building campaigns in order to keep children out of the adult criminal justice system. I'm talking to Marcy Mistret, the Chief Executive Officer of the Campaign for Youth Justice, which is based in Washington, D.C. So, Marcy, can you tell us a little bit about the organization and your role in it?
Absolutely. It's nice to be here today with you, Zoe. As you said, I'm the CEO at the Campaign for Youth Justice. We are located in Washington, D.C. We're a national advocacy organization that's committed to ending the practice of prosecuting, sentencing, and incarcerating youth in the adult criminal justice system. We work really closely with our state partners, national allies, and impacted youth and families to advocate for legislative change.
So how and why did the Youth Justice Awareness Month come about, which is what you're promoting right now?
Yeah, that's correct. We like to call Youth Justice Awareness Month, affectionately we call it YJAM around here. But families have always been a cornerstone of our work at the campaign. And one of the family members we met early on when we opened is a woman named Tracy McClard. Tracy lives in Missouri, and she actually was the one that launched YJAM in 2008 in memory of her son Jonathan, who tragically committed suicide in an adult jail when he was 17. So Tracy continues to activate her networks in Missouri every year for YJAM, but now she's joined by thousands of others across the country every October.
Has the number of children and youth under 18 being prosecuted in the adult criminal justice system decreased or increased since the Campaign for Youth Justice opened its doors in 2005, I believe, is when you started?
Yes, that's correct. This is a tricky question, only because data on prosecution is very, very hard to come by. What I can say is that the daily count of young people under the age of 18 who are housed in adult jails and prisons has dropped significantly since 2000. There used to be more than 10,000 children on a given day. We're now under 5,000. However, what I want to make note of is that we really can't lose sight of the fact that even though we've made great progress on that number, it is still double the number of young people we sent into the adult system before the Get Tough era of the 1990s. So we're making progress, but we're not even close to there yet. I think if you extrapolate that out, the best numbers we have are from Human Rights Watch and the ACLU that issued a report several years ago now that estimated that number to be at about 95,000 children a year.
So what are the main issues that you focus on during Youth Justice Awareness Month, and do they change from year to year?
So YJAM really focuses on issues that are pertinent to children who are prosecuted as adults. But we also do look more broadly at the system of juvenile justice. Sadly, there's never a shortage of issues to choose from. Some years we highlight disparately impacted populations like youth of color or LGBT youth, youth with maybe mental health or learning differences. Other years we like to really focus on things like storytelling and highlighting stories from families and young people that have been impacted by the system and what they're doing now. And other times we look at things more like safety issues and conditions around confinement, things like the overuse of solitary confinement and the high risk of suicide that these young people face while they're incarcerated. This year, we're really excited because we've decided to make the shift. We're moving from Youth Justice Awareness into Youth Justice Action Month. So we've got plenty of opportunities for people to weigh into and ways for them to take action in their local communities.
What kind of things are people doing?
There's a lot of things that we ask people to do, you know, through social media. We ask them to chalk all over their communities and talk about why this is a failed public policy. We have several federal bills that impact local states. We ask them to either call their governor or their U.S. senator and representative to try to advocate for laws that will reduce the number of young people in the adult system. And then on top of that, if people have smaller events or just want to talk to their neighbors, we have all sorts of opportunities to connect with the arts, so poetry or movies or films with discussion questions to help educate people about this issue. Online, we have an entire webpage dedicated to this, and there's a resource section there that has a whole list of ideas of things that you can do during YJAM. Some states have actually asked for proclamations from their governor or local state authorities supporting Youth Justice Awareness Month and laws and practices that support the values behind it. So it's an exciting time. So the website address is www.cfyj.org/YJAM, YJAM.
So let's get into talking about some of the actual issues. It seems that many people in the general public focus more on their gut reaction to crimes themselves rather than on the mitigating or precipitating factors that lead to them, and that people have little or no more sympathy for juveniles who commit crimes than they do for adults who commit crimes. One frequently hears the phrase, "They were old enough to know what they were doing, so they should be punished as adults." What do you say to people when they object to the idea of offending juveniles getting different treatment from that which offending adults are subjected to?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what we generally find is that people who have that as their first response to the question of what we do and how we should treat young people who are involved is that they really don't have a good understanding of what the system looks like. I think, you know, once you can start to walk them through the differences of the youth and the adult systems, they pretty quickly come around and understand that children are better served in a system that was designed for them. It doesn't mean that they're not going to be held accountable. It just means that they're going to be held accountable in a way that gets to some of the root causes and gives them the opportunity to correct things and learn different ways of managing, you know, problem solving or, you know, peer pressure or whatever it is, or their mental health issues, so that they'll be less likely to offend in the future. The Supreme Court has issued statements on this 5 times in the past decade, articulating very clearly that young people are different from adults. And I think a lot of times we just have to walk people step by step through that to say, we're not saying children shouldn't be held accountable. We're just saying that children think differently and act differently and respond to punishment or intervention differently than adults. And we need to take that into consideration when responding to them.
So are there any aggravating factors that usually or invariably channel minors into the adult criminal justice system away from the juvenile justice system?
So I want to just take 1 second, Zoe, to reframe the beginning of your question. Because sadly, in the United States, it used to be that judges transferring kids into the adult system was the primary way that young people did get moved from the youth to the adult system. That's no longer the case. Right now, what we've moved in the past 20 years is really to a system where children are automatically excluded or prosecutors have the right to determine, not judges, which court children start in.
They're automatically excluded from the juvenile system.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that point. So depending on their age and the crime, they're automatically start in the adult system.
So then what happens? What's the next process?
And so then a judge will hear their case. And some of the mitigating factors, in many states, the criminal court judge can opt to reverse waive the child back. A lot of times that request has to be made by the defense attorney. Not all defense attorneys know that they have that right to request that. Getting to your aggravating factors, some of the things that we can look at is what the Supreme Court talked about in their decision in the Miller case. So really taking into account their age, what was happening in their lives, what were the surrounding circumstances behind whatever led to their arrest, you know, their histories, and what their opportunities are for reform.
Can you just explain to listeners what the Miller versus Alabama ruling is in a nutshell?
So basically what that case did was to say that it is not enough to say that you can't just sentence children to life without parole. You actually have to take into consideration the unique characteristics of their age in determining sentencing. So that it really did talk about the fact that an adolescent brain looks very different from an adult brain, and you need to consider that when you are considering what an appropriate punishment should be for that child.
And that ruling was in 2012.
That is correct.
Now, you mentioned something about many defense attorneys not realizing that they have the right to petition to keep a juvenile in the juvenile system rather than proceed in the adult system. That's actually very disturbing that defense attorneys aren't aware of that. And that brings me to my next question, which is, do criminal defense attorneys who take on juvenile cases tend to specialize in working with minors, or do they take on juvenile cases as just an occasional variation in their overall work with adult defendants?
Yes, this is another reason that we really like all cases to originate in the juvenile court, because defense attorneys in the juvenile court system are more likely to receive training specifically around adolescent development and have a context for understanding children's behavior. In the adult system, that is not the case. You know, you might have major urban areas, places like LA and New York, that have a specialized team that deal with children that are considered youthful offenders. However, in many, many places, you're talking about attorneys who might be contract attorneys or panel attorneys that have no training whatsoever, that they get one of these cases, you know, occasionally, and they just don't have the knowledge and the understanding about the intricacies that happen when a young person who's under the age of 18 gets involved in the adult system. It's alarming. It's tragic in many, many ways. And there's a lot of good people out there trying to ensure that they do have access to the knowledge. But it's complicated case law.
Now, would you say that as a general rule, kids across the country in the United States are getting specialized juvenile attorneys, or that generally speaking, they just tend to get attorneys who are generalists who just happen to be taking on their case with no training? Would you say that they're generally getting attorneys who are not trained specially in child and adolescent issues?
I think really what the problem is in the United States, honestly, Zoe, in the criminal justice system, is that the rights to indigent defense is incredibly varied state by state, county by county. They are completely under-resourced. And we can't lose sight of the fact that many of these kids, their best option is a plea negotiation.
Because they can't afford a private attorney.
Correct. Correct. So this is a much bigger issue. I mean, you know, certainly our kids are impacted by it because their numbers relative to the adult population are so small. So your chance of getting quality defense in the first place is questionable in many, many places across the country. And then secondarily, to have adequate defense that is specialized in adolescent development is even more rare.
Let's talk about kids in the system and what they go through. What would you say are the main disadvantages and dangers to minors being processed through the adult criminal justice system, to juveniles themselves, to their families, to the criminal justice system, and to society?
First and foremost, to the young people themselves, we can't lose sight of the fact for many of them, as a matter of fact, the vast majority of them, this is their first contact with the criminal justice system. They have no idea what's happening to them. They are placed into adult facilities. And many times what that means is they have to be sight and sound separated from the general population. So they're placed in isolation. They have very limited access to their families. And they're spending a lot of time pending trial because the outcomes are so potentially damaging that defense attorneys are taking a long time making sure that they, you know, when they can, that they have the information necessary to make a good outcome for that young person. Once they're there, we know that young people are much more subjected to physical assault, sexual assault, verbal assault, both by correctional officers and other incarcerated people. So that leads to suicide rates that are way surpass any risk that the young people would face if they were in a youth facility. So it's severe. We lose young people every year to suicide who have been charged in the adult system. I think a big piece on the families is because this young person is now in the eyes of the law an adult, their families are not consulted. We have families call frequently that are panicked because they have no idea where their child is. And the attitude of the court is, this child is an adult. You don't have the right to know where they are. And, you know, they're not part of the defense team. They're not consulted before decisions are made because the client is the child. And then once, if they are incarcerated, they are often placed far away from families. They're disconnected from those families, you know, and it's incredibly devastating to everyone involved.
You said the system regards them as adults. So you're talking about a combination of factors there. You're talking about whether they've been adjudicated as an adult for a particular crime. So you were talking they could even be 14 or 15, even if they're not technically an adult. And you're also talking about the different rules that different states have for when kids are regarded as adults across the board. So I think there are 9 or 10 states that regard juveniles automatically as adults once they hit 17.
So, yeah, actually, we've made some really great progress in that area. So there's only 2 states that automatically consider children to be adults at 16 and 5 that automatically consider children adults at 17. So we're down to 7 states, which is the lowest number in the history of the United States. So we're making great progress. We call those our raise the age states. And those actually have the biggest number of young people in the adult system. So places like New York, 33 children a year are charged as adults simply as a function of their age. And so we're trying to get them back to the juvenile court system because most of them could be diverted effectively. You're talking about kids who maybe jumped a turnstile at the train station or walked off with, you know, in school with somebody else's backpack. They're pretty minor adjustments that could be handled or diverted from court. Don't forget, the adult system doesn't have a diversion option.
Can you explain what a diversion option is?
Yeah, so diversion means that either at the point of arrest or at the point of charge, that either the prosecutor or the judge can decide, you know what, this child really doesn't need to be here. And they can divert them. They can say, instead of coming to court, what we want you to do is go to school every day, work with a truancy officer, and we want you to check in, make sure your parents, that you're home by curfew every night. If you do that, this is going to go away. In 6 months, you won't have any, there'll be no record of it at all. We're diverting you from the system. The criminal justice system has no such mechanism. If you get arrested, you're going to go to court. Your best case scenario is that you get fined and a misdemeanor charge on your record.
Just going back to the system regarding you as an adult, there are certain crimes for which children are automatically regarded as adults, regardless of their age. It's more to do with the heinousness of the crime. So are you saying that, for example, if a child has killed and the system puts them in the adult system for the severity of the crime rather than for their chronological age, that at that point the parents lose the right to access to them because the child is now being processed in the adult system? So is that what happens even if they're put in the adult system because of the heinousness of the crime, that the parents then lose the rights that they would normally have with regard to their child?
That's correct. And that goes from everything from the point of arrest. So again, if you're considered to be a juvenile, you have the right to have a parent or legal representation there, even during questioning with the police. When you're charged as an adult, that right goes away.
So you can be a 13-year-old killer, and because you are going to be processed in the adult system for the severity of the crime, you lose all your rights as a child and your parents lose all their rights as parents with regard to you.
That is correct. And the only other thing I want to reframe here is that you're mentioning homicide. Children commit very few homicides in our country. I know the media makes it seem like that's describing this. But really, most of these young people are going to the adult system for robberies and assaults. And way too many of them are going up for nothing nearly as major as that. Everyone goes to the homicide or the horrible aggravated sexual assault or rape. That is so few children of what we're talking about. We need people to understand that many, many of these children are going up for even things that aren't felonies.
So what are the criminal justice practices that are especially concerning with regard to juveniles in the adult system when they're in long term? The harmful impact of putting a child in the adult system over the long term, not just in the immediate arrest and charging period.
Sure. So if a child is convicted as an adult, they go into an adult facility. There are no mental health services provided for that child that takes into account their age. If they're facing a long sentence, they're not going to have access to those limited services a lot of times because they kind of prioritize services to young people who are on their way home. And then they're going to be, again, far away from their homes. They're going to be subject. We've seen over and over again that they are much more likely to be victimized while they're there. And that is, you know, you can never undo that. We got to remember that the adult system in the United States really is focused on punishment. It does no longer, I mean, really for 40, 50 years has lost its rehabilitative function tremendously. If you're in an adult prison, you don't get access to Pell Grants. If you're in a youth facility, you do get access to Pell Grants, which is the government loan to take further education. Your rights to education are compromised in the adult system because, again, it's not focused on rehabilitation. It's not focused on any of the services that might help you once you leave prison. And I suppose the biggest harm is that you're going to carry that conviction around with you the rest of your life, and it's going to have all of the disenfranchising impacts that it does on adults, except for it's going to start a lot younger. So children who have never signed a contract are going to be ineligible to sign a whole lot of contracts once they come out. The barriers are insurmountable for many.
So what kinds of developmentally appropriate rehabilitative programs and services does the Campaign for Youth Justice advocate for children and youth as an alternative to the adult criminal justice system?
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, our juvenile justice system is nothing to write home about in terms of being perfect, a perfect solution for children who come in contact with the law. But first and foremost, they far exceed what we do for adults in this country. And then secondly, what I will say is those that are run well really look at the child as an individual. They consider the family or other mentors and guardians in that child's life to be part of the solution. They offer intensive mental health, substance abuse, physical health services that wrap around that child. Each child has an individualized plan. Young people go to school every day. They're mandated to do so. There are a lot more services that engage families, so families and younger siblings are able to come visit in many places. It's just a place that's really focused on getting the child back home and stabilized instead of a place that's focused on punishment and when they're run well.
Let's talk a bit about Montgomery, because Montgomery is obviously a big thing. This year, following the landmark Supreme Court Montgomery versus Louisiana ruling that came down in January, all American states are having to start the long process of reevaluating the approximately 2,500 still living prisoners who were incarcerated as juveniles and given a life without parole sentence, some as long ago as 50 or 60 years. Can you explain what the Montgomery ruling means for those who were sentenced to die in prison for crimes they were convicted of committing as juveniles?
The Supreme Court has come down in favor of treating children differently from adults 5 times in the past decade. And what Montgomery, I talked a little bit earlier about what the case preceding Montgomery did, and that was the case, as you said, the Miller case that said that you have to take certain conditions of the uniqueness of the child's age when it comes to sentencing. Miller, however, was not retroactive. They didn't talk about the fact whether or not, how that decision impacts, as you said, the 2,500 children who had been sentenced to die in prison. So what Montgomery does is go back and say, yeah, this is retroactive. You've got to look at these young people. You've got to give them an opportunity for parole.
Some who are not young people anymore, they're in their 50s and 60s, or even in some cases, 70s.
Oh, yeah, tragically. Yes, we are no longer talking about children. These are people who have spent decades and decades of their life with no hope of coming home. So Montgomery, you know, gives them that opportunity. And I think what we're finding with Montgomery is the flaws in our parole systems, but it is a chance and a hope and an opportunity. And I think actually just this week, somebody came home after 60 years because of the Montgomery finding.
I have a collaboration with a juvenile lifer who himself is hoping to be freed within the next year or so, but he's at the slightly younger scale. He's in his early 40s. My impression is that they're focusing on the older cases to begin with. They're prioritizing the older cases.
And many of these cases, I mean, they're disproportionately come from certain places. As you said, you know, Philadelphia has, I think, a little more than 10%.
Pennsylvania has 500 of the 2,500. It's the state with the largest number of juvenile lifers. In fact, it's the place with the largest number of juvenile lifers in the world. And of those 500 in Pennsylvania, 300 are from the Philadelphia area. And our juvenile lifer who we're featuring is from Philadelphia. He's in Greaterford, Giovanni Reed. And I asked him to be involved because I wanted to follow his case to see how this process goes on, because he's a good sort of average age, if you like, He's waiting right now for his resentencing hearing. His sentence has already been vacated. It was vacated in April. So he's in that kind of limbo period now where he's just waiting for a hearing for his actual resentencing. But now one thing that I've picked up on that is a slight subtle change, a slight subtle difference, is that apparently what seems to be happening in Pennsylvania, at least with these people who are being granted parole and are being released, is that rather than being released in the spirit of Montgomery, in the sense of being resentenced with a sentence that would have been more appropriate had they been given a juvenile appropriate sentence, what seems to be happening is that they are taking a sort of modified adult sentence plea deal. So it seems that the spirit of it is that it's more a case of resentencing these people to a modified lesser adult sentence rather than fully taking on the spirit of Montgomery and saying, okay, had we sentenced you as a juvenile, we would have sentenced you this way. Therefore, you've served your time. Goodbye. It's a subtle difference, but apparently that's what's going on, at least in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that, right? So, I mean, I would say that, you know, there's many judges that are locked into mandatory minimums now, right? So they haven't had to struggle through this because it's been taken out of their hands. So I think that that's one thing that might be contributing. I think a second thing that might be contributing is just that punitive nature. What drives the penalty is the charge. So mitigation is just not equally considered in the adult system. It is not balanced at all. So I think even if we have these very clear instructions and guidance, again, your judges haven't been trained in adolescent development. You can bring experts in front of them, but that is incredibly expensive and time consuming. And I just think it's going to take time till the criminal court gets up to speed with this. I mean, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. And what we hear over and over again, I can change tremendously in prison, but my charge never will. And if that's still what is the, still even in the parole hearings, if that's still what is the determination, the determining cause, it's going to be tough.
As large numbers of these prisoners are being released, the former juvenile lifers, as they're called, in the coming years, none of whom have ever lived as adults in a free society, and most of whom would have spent decades in prison, what do you foresee as their main challenges following release and the challenges to society that will be receiving them?
Well, it's interesting. There's a couple things. So, I mean, we're already hearing about cases where there's nowhere for the person to live because they have this felony conviction for a violent crime and all their family lives in public housing. And that's what's holding them up. What we have to remember is that, again, in the era of the 1990s, we really made convictions a lifetime sentence, even if you're not incarcerated. So there's a whole list of collateral consequences that will follow children and adults around the rest of their life. And this particularly applies to the children who were to juvenile lifers. They will be prohibited from working in entire huge industries because of that felony conviction. So their job prospects reduce. It will be very, very difficult for them to find housing. They will be restricted from public housing. They will also be restricted from signing contracts and legal leases in many places. So we have a lot of lifers who are able to sublet rooms in homes, but aren't able to be the primary person on a lease. You've got people who will not be able to vote. I think the Sentencing Project this week just came out with those numbers. And this is, again, general adults, not just lifers, but 6.1 million people permanently disenfranchised because of a conviction. Education. President Obama has done some work around this year. You know, if you want to go back to college, let's say if you were able to earn your GED while you were incarcerated or before you were incarcerated in rare circumstances, and you want to continue your education, well, you have to disclose whether you've been charged, even just charged, or found guilty of a felony. And that will make you, you know, they said that 60% of people who start to fill out the college application process, once they get to that question, they stop filling it out. So there's a ton of barriers. There's been a lot of movement around the Ban the Box initiative. Are employers able to ask that on their paper application? Again, huge barrier to people even filling out job applications.
At the beginning, I asked you about some of the general public's attitude to different treatment of juveniles in the criminal justice system. Now, with regard to this gradual release, now just starting all over the country, of juvenile lifers as they get resentenced and paroled, there are many families of victims who are going to be vehemently opposed to this new development, and indeed already are.
What we have to remember about the criminal justice system in our country is that not only is it harsh to the people who are charged with crimes, but it is incredibly disrespectful of victims. We've been doing a lot of work, and I'm going to point to our national partners here, the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. And they're really the national organization that is honing in on this population of juvenile lifers and trying to give them second chances. And they do wonderful, wonderful work with victims and survivors and family members who have lost people that they really love as a result of criminal behavior. And I think what is coming out over and over again is that victims, for the most part, want to be sure that this will never happen to anyone else, right? There is certainly the pain and the rawness and how difficult it is to lose somebody. And I'm not saying that every victim of a crime gets to that place, but I think what we're starting to see is that victims are understanding that most people do come home, and when they do come home, if they've spent a tremendous number of years in places that are inhumane, they're not going to come home better people. And I think that that human piece of it is changing the dialogue. We hear from victims all of the time how they weren't heard by the prosecutor, how no one listened to them, how there was no one there to support them as they were going through, you know, many, many continuances and hearings, and how difficult it was for them. And certainly sentencing does bring that all up again. It is trauma that, you know, people are in different ways of healing. But I think what we're starting to see is victims saying, we want them to get the treatment that they need and the rehabilitative services they need so that this doesn't ever happen to anyone else again.
Right. So the disrespect of the victims, as you said, is in terms of not rehabilitating prisoners enough so that they can come out and make a contribution to society. The worse you treat them, the more punishing the system, the more likely they are to come out and be recidivists.
Yes. Yes. You know, that's not going to apply to every victim. There's some victims that this is just too much for them, right? They do want people to go away forever. But I think in general, especially if people were children at the time where the crime was committed, there is the hope that they're for rehabilitation and for second chances.
So in a nutshell, if a family member calls you and expresses their disgust or consternation at the idea of all these juvenile lifers being freed following the Montgomery ruling, what would you say to them?
I think the first thing is always to acknowledge, if somebody calls me and they're in that much pain, I think the first thing you have to do, if I'm asking the system to be compassionate, I think we always have to start with compassion, right? So I think it is listening. I think it is having a compassionate response about that person's loss and the pain. And then I think it's about opening a discussion about what would make this better. And then talking about the amount of time that has been spent and how we want to help this person come back and contribute to society. And I think many people can get there. I think you will have some that can't. But I also think that what we find and what we know about this population of young people who have been sentenced to juvenile life without parole is that they were frequently and repeatedly victims before they were arrested with any crime. So I think there's also, you know, we tend to think that victimization happens over here to this group of people and the perpetrators over here and this other group of people. But I think if you start to uncover that, they're one and the same. Many of our children who have contact in the juvenile or criminal justice systems have been exposed to tremendous levels of violence and victimization themselves before they were ever arrested.
So we're in the first week now of the Youth Justice Awareness Campaign, just coming to the end of the first week of October. So how can people take action and participate during this month in the Youth Justice Awareness Campaign?
Yeah, and I think I touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but we have on our website a list of activities that are already going on in states across the country. We also encourage people to host some of their friends, come over, watch a film, have a dialogue about this. Educate your neighbor. I think we also have two actions. There's two federal bills pending and several states whose governors aren't protecting children who are in adult jails and prisons. How to get involved in that is on our website. I think I failed to mention President Obama did issue a proclamation on September 30th declaring this October Youth Justice Awareness Month. And in that proclamation, he encourages all of us to do something for children this month. So that could also mean your action is to reach out to a young person who might not be making their right, the best choices or the best decisions, mentoring them, getting them involved in a positive activity. So those are some of the other things that I think we can all do on a day-to-day basis to help make the experiences of young people more positive.
Right, because juvenile justice isn't just about kids involved in the criminal justice system. It's actually about preventing kids becoming involved.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much. This has been really interesting and really great. And I'm sure the listeners will get a lot of information from this, things that they probably didn't even know. I've certainly learned a lot.
You've been listening to Juvie, conceived, written, and produced by Zoe Badovinic. Join us next time on Juvie.